At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, your host. Is abortion a fundamental right protected by the U.S. Constitution? That's a question that's been debated since Roe v. Wade in 1973, and most recently since the Dobbs decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last year. Even though abortion has been defederalized through the Dobbs decision, it's being hotly debated at the state level. So how should we think about abortion? Is it a right for women who find themselves in unexpected pregnancies? Or is it a grievous wrong that a human life has been unjustly killed? Joining us to discuss further is Alexandra DeSantis, who is a staff writer at National Review, a visiting fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and a leading pro-life advocate who's been published in The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, and New York Times. Alexandra, welcome to The Commonwealth Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, hey, it's great to have you join us. Tell us about your book. I've been familiar with you for some time. I'm a regular reader at National Review, and I'm familiar with some of your writing. But you and Ryan Anderson co-authored a book last year called Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. And I was in touch with Ryan recently, and he volunteered you for the program, by the way. So
Thanks, Ryan.
But anyways, I got a hold of the book, and I'm maybe a quarter of the way through it. Really good read. And I mentioned to you before the program, I don't know how I missed this book, how it did not get on my radar. But tell us, I guess, first of all, why did you write this book?
So the idea came about, I've been writing about abortion and the pro-life issue for National Review for about 7 years now. It was my main focus at National Review. And I joined the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where I'm now a fellow. And I wanted to write a book about abortion. This was before, you know, Dobbs was even on the Supreme Court's radar. And so Ryan and I were kind of talking through what's the best way to write a book about this. Would someone publish it? And then once it became clear that the court was going to hear the Dobbs case, we thought this was an opening for a publisher, you know, might be interested a little more in the issue. It would be a good time to sell a book on this. And so when I kind of wrote up my proposal, Ryan was helping me with that. He ended up suggesting that we write it together. I'm really glad we ended up doing that. And the idea of the book was, look, if Roe v. Wade is about to be overturned, which we both believed it would be, and we're very grateful that it was, we wanted to equip pro-lifers with the best facts, the best information, the best statistics, the best arguments and talking points for going out into this new post-Roe America, right? This is, as we've seen over the last year, really uncharted territory. It's a major challenge. The fight over abortion is far from over, although it was a big win. And so the idea of the book is, as pro-lifers in a post-Roe America, here's how we talk about this issue. Here are the best arguments against abortion.
It's almost like a legal case that you present. And I'm going to go over some of the chapter headings that you have. First of all, and most obvious to the pro-life movement, is that abortion harms the unborn child. In chapter two, you say that abortion harms women and the family to some degree. Most in the pro-life women understand that. Chapter three, abortion harms equality and choice. That's an argument or a subject that we don't hear of very often. Abortion harms medicine. That's chapter four. Abortion harms the rule of law. Abortion harms politics and the democratic process. And abortion harms media and popular culture. You're covering a wide array of subjects there, several that we haven't really thought of. I want to go with that last one, though, how abortion harms media and popular culture. And I think this is evident through much of television programming and the way the news is reported. And that's something I want to hone in on. I have written columns on sanctity of life issues in the past, and my columns have been accepted by some of the major news outlets in Kentucky, with the exception that I changed some of the language. For example, they don't like to use the term abortionist. And so long as I agreed to change terms like that, they'd be happy to carry my column. Tell us more, if you would, about how abortion corrupts media.
Sure. Yeah, this was a chapter that I really enjoyed writing, although it's obviously a very frustrating topic. But I enjoyed writing this because so much of what I'd been doing at National Review was just finding examples of really bad reporting in mainstream outlets and explaining this is not wrong. Here's where all the facts are wrong. Here's where the terminology is, you know, obscuring that the reality of what's happening here. It's very, very hard, in fact, to find accurate, factual, reliable coverage of abortion in any of the mainstream papers, which I think is a real grievous problem, right? And I think from what I've seen, it's a combination of some willfully ignorant or, you know, kind of malicious reporters who are pro-abortion and do this on purpose. There are certainly some examples of that we talk about in the book. But I also think there's a lot of just actually ignorant people in the media who kind of just are fed the pro-choice line that this is a women's rights issue. They don't dig into the details. They don't cover it fairly. They just assume that the pro-abortion movement is the right one. And so they do produce really lazy reporting, which we see on a whole host of other issues, of course. And so what we look at in the book is, how does this, you know, not only is this a problem for the media itself, but how does this corruption shape the popular debate? Because most people get their information from these sources, right? Very few people, unless you're already very conservative or pro-life, is going to be seeking out my work or Ryan's work or what you do. And so how do we get the truth of what we're trying to say to these people when there's such a stranglehold on so much of the media?
Yeah, I want to go into some of the talking points or phraseology that mainstream media picks up and they repeat over and over. And so one of the phrases, especially since Dobbs, where this issue has been debated at the state level, we hear of terms like bans off our bodies. We hear of forced pregnancy, forced birthing. If you don't like abortion, don't have one. And these phrases are repeated over and over, and people mindlessly repeat that. Like, that's the end of the beginning and the end of the argument, right? So how do we, can you give us some pointers as to how to overcome some of this phraseology, or maybe not get caught in the trap of playing along with those terms and phrases?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do talk about all those things you mentioned, plus plenty more in the book. We do a lot of debunking and kind of the best way to phrase a pro-life response to these things. I'll take just one example. You mentioned, if you don't like an abortion, don't have one. If you don't like abortion, don't have one, right? We talk about this in the first chapter about how abortion harms the unborn child. And we point out that surely everyone would see the problem with the statement, if you don't like a slave, don't, if you don't like slavery, don't own a slave. Mm-hmm. Right? That's not, we've accepted as a society that, you know, trying to enslave another human being is a grievous evil, right? A grave wrong. We don't do that to other human beings. And so as a society, we've outlawed this. We don't practice this anymore. We look back with horror on the fact that this was ever accepted. So the idea that, you know, what's right for me is right for me and what's right for you is right for you, and we don't impose that on each other, is actually not true. We don't accept that logic for a whole host of evil things. And so the argument really isn't whether I should impose my view of abortion or someone else should get to impose their view of abortion, but rather, is this a grave moral evil or isn't it, right? Is abortion right or is it wrong? Is it killing a human being, an innocent human being, or is it not? And if it is, should we permit that as a society, right? That's the argument. And so I think what you'll find with a lot of the kind of slogans that you mentioned is they're a smokescreen in front of the real issue, right? The heart of the issue is this a human being? Is it right or wrong to kill innocent human beings? And if it's wrong, what are we going to do about it? Right? What do we do as a society? Are we okay with that? And I think if you kind of try and draw the issue back to that heart of it, you'll find the person on the other side getting very frustrated. That's why they come up with these slogans, because they want to avoid that crux of the issue.
Alexandra, I agree with you. What you're saying is reasonable. It's logical. It starts with science, right? When does a new human life come into existence? Well, it's at fertilization. It's at conception. But I would argue, if I could push back a little bit, that we don't live in a reasonable age. We live in a post-truth age where reason and logic they're not respected like they once were. And emotion trumps everything. I mean, that's part of the definition of post-truth. It's where strong emotional sentiment trumps facts. It's my subjective reality. And here you're dealing with an issue that's very personal, very subjective. And I think many people who don't think through this want to embrace, or they gravitate towards these hollow slogans. They sound good, and it sounds like it puts to rest the opposition. But here's my question. how do we, in a post-truth, highly subjective, highly emotive age, break through that smokescreen, break through all of that to win over hearts and minds? I know that's a lot there and probably not going to solve it all in this 20 minutes that we have left, but where can we start in breaking through in this post-truth age on this issue of restoring the sanctity of life?
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that you raised that. I think you're certainly right. And that's really part of why we took the tactic that we did in the book, which is, as you mentioned, you know, you read the chapter titles. Very little of the book focuses directly on abortion as killing a human being, right? That's the first chapter. It's the most important chapter. I think it's the most fundamental harm of abortion. But we realized pro-lifers are very good at talking about this, right? We're very good at saying this is killing an innocent human being. This is evil. This is wrong. You know, it's unjust, the whole litany. But the argument in the book is there are a lot of people who've heard that argument many, many, many times, and it's not working, right? There are a lot of people who've been converted by it, certainly, but there are a lot of people who don't care. Either they don't believe it, or they don't want to hear it, or they don't care. And so the rest of the book is looking at, look at all these ways that abortion has harmed everybody, right? That, I mean, the subtitle kind of gives that away, but if it is true that abortion is killing an innocent human being, and if it is true that that's a grave moral evil, how could we be better off as a society, as a people, for allowing that? And so I guess the idea of the book is that a pro-lifer who's in conversation with someone who doesn't agree with them will be able to come back and say, okay, you know, this is a human being, this is a grave moral evil, but I hear you, person who supports abortion, saying that you think women need it. Did you know that many women who have abortions actually suffer psychological consequences for many, many years after the fact, or whatever it is that the other person is arguing? Meet them where they are, right? Here, if it's an emotional argument, try to find the good in what they're saying. Of course, being pro-abortion is not good, but oftentimes there's some kind of truthful or good motivation underlying their argument. Like, they're afraid women will suffer. They're afraid there'll be, you know, many impoverished babies roaming around with no one to care for them or whatever. Learn how to speak to the issue that they're concerned about, right? And some people won't care. Some people are malicious. But I think for a lot of people, you can really gain a lot of ground like that.
Yeah, no, I what I'm hearing from you is you're talking about empathy, putting yourself in the woman's shoes, listening to her story, or at least when you're debating this issue, being empathetic and then steering them in a direction that would perhaps shed light on the truth of the fact that this decision really doesn't lead to a better life or improved outcome for the woman in a difficult pregnancy or difficult situation. And you mentioned this at length in your book. You cite research that indicate that women are not happier short-term. Their short-term happiness has declined since Roe v. Wade in 1973, and their long-term happiness has declined as well. And you point to abortion as being part of their decline in happiness. Alexandra, you mentioned that you talk about the obligation, the moral relationship between the mother and the child, and that there's a duty for the mother to care for the child, and that abortion, and this is in chapter one, abortion introduces violence into this sacred relationship between the mother and her unborn child. And many of us haven't really thought of it that way. This does make sense. It is logical. But would you say that this is one of the reasons why women's happiness in general has declined in the last 50 years since Roe v. Wade?
I do think so. And an argument we talk about certainly in the first chapter and also in the chapter on how abortion harms women is the fact that abortion was introduced as, you know, this boon to women, right? And it's still defended in this way. You know, it'll be a good thing for women if they can essentially do away with unwanted pregnancies in the same way that men can simply walk away. And I think what we found is actually abortion has incentivized kind of a sexual landscape or a landscape of sexual interactions that leaves women even more dependent and more alone than they otherwise would have been. You know, whereas once there was kind of a social expectation that men would support women and their, you know, whatever children they happen to conceive. Now, if a man wants to walk away from that responsibility, he can simply say, well, have an abortion. And if you don't want to, it's not my problem, right? And maybe there's some financial support. But we have a culture wherein it's normalized that abandonment of women and children is going to happen. And the solution, the supposed solution, is women can now engage in this act of violence to abandon their child too. And I think it's pretty obvious why women are not actually better off in that situation. You know, the idea that you are equal to men because now you can commit violence against your own child and be similarly free, I don't think that's really a freeing proposition at all. And of course, there are situations where women do need help, or, you know, there is a reason why it would be hard to bring their child into the world. But I don't think we're really prospering as a society if our best solution is, well, why don't you just go kill your child, right? And then everything will be okay. I think that's a very impoverished solution.
How would you address those who say, look, since women have had legalized abortion, and if they find themselves in a difficult pregnancy, let's say it would interrupt their studies or interrupt their career path that they're on because of abortion, it has allowed women to move ahead in society, in their schooling, in the work world. How would you address that? And that's a common argument that we hear today.
Yeah, we do hear that a lot. We certainly talk about that in the book. And I think there are a couple angles to this. One is that I think if you look at the data, and some of my colleagues at the Ethics and Public Policy Center do a lot of work with kind of family policy data, but you'll find that many women actually would prefer to have more children than they end up having. And many women would prefer to spend more time at home, even if they'd like some sort of part-time work arrangement, they'd prefer to spend more time with their children than they get to. And I think abortion in some ways has accelerated that problem, where it's expected that if you want to succeed in the work world, your path has to look very much like the path of a man. If you want to be in the corner office, you better be at work. And there's no place really there for childbearing. And so we're seeing, borne out in the data, a lot of women delaying marriage, delaying childbearing, having fewer children than they'd like, spending less time with their children than they'd like, because it's been made clear that because of contraception and abortion, we're living in this society where it's expected for women to be as present, as available, as unencumbered as men. And so women are, you know, if they want to be in the workplace at all, that's the model they have to conform to. Whereas I think a world without contraception and abortion, or certainly without abortion, you don't have that kind of backstop of getting rid of the child and getting back to work. You would ideally have a society that welcomes both men and women and the unique things they have to offer in the workplace with more flexibility and not this kind of rigid, you're either a worker or you belong at home model.
Yeah, no, that's good. If you're just joining us, I'm Richard Nelson here with Alexandra DeSantis, and we're talking about the abortion issue and her recent book with Ryan Anderson called Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that the news media isn't always fair. In fact, there's lots of far-left bias and political gamesmanship. No surprise there. So if you're looking for a perspective that's grounded in the truth of Scripture and our nation's founding principles, then get plugged into CPC's resources. Sign up for our e-newsletter at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Commonwealth Policy Center. And we're on Twitter at CPC4Kentucky.
Welcome back to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Alexandra DeSantis. And just before the break, we were talking about some of the arguments that have been used to justify abortion, in particular, how it has helped women or put women in a better place to get ahead in society or to unencumber them as they pursue academic studies or the work world. But Alexandra, you made a good point that I think implied in the point you were making was that men and women are different. And what I was hearing is that many women would find greater happiness if they had a family, if they had more children, if they were able to spend more time with their children. And the metrics, I think, for happiness, the happiness of men and women, married men and women are different than what has been imposed on them. I want to go into this. Abortion today has been sold as a woman's issue where men should not speak into it. And it's been billed as, in particular, a woman's rights issue where this is somehow an endowed right. Can you speak to that? I'm a guy who's pro-life, by the way, and I'm pro-life because I think it's a justice issue, and I think I do have a voice when it comes to public policy in speaking on behalf of unborn life. But can you speak to this?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you bring this up because I do a lot of talks for students, particularly high school and college students. And almost every single time I give a talk, at least one male student will ask a question at the end saying, we're always told men can't talk about this issue. What am I supposed to do? I think this is a really pressing question among pro-lifers for obvious reasons. And I think it's really important. What I always say is every child has a mother and a father. Right. Of course, a mother has a particular responsibility and role in, you know, bringing the child into the world, carrying the child in her womb. That can't be replaced by a man. But if you look at the statistics, actually, many, many women, in fact, most women who have an abortion cite lack of support from the child's father as one of the main reasons why they feel they can't, you know, have their child, why they're having an abortion instead. And I think, honestly, the biggest solution, if you want to get rid of abortion, it's not public policy, although policy is very important. It's support from the child's father. right? Male abandonment, lack of male support, pressure, coercion into getting an abortion is a huge factor in why women seek abortion. Many women would prefer to have their child, even if it wasn't the time they wanted to or it wasn't in the plan. Many women, once they're pregnant, would prefer to have their child than have an abortion, but they feel alone. And that's why you see things like pregnancy resource centers being so successful at helping women choose life, because women just want to be told, you can do this, right? Well, not only can you do it, but we'll be with you, we'll support you. And how much more does that support mean from the father of the child? And so I think the idea that men don't have a role in the conversation because men don't get pregnant, which also, by the way, is up for debate right now. So it's a little bit of a constant issue on the left, I think, at the moment. They don't even know if men can get pregnant. But given that women are the ones getting pregnant, that doesn't mean that the woman's the only one involved, right? There's a father for every child, and men have a role in saying, look, this is unjust. It can be unjust whether you're a man or a woman, and men have a role here to stop abortion.
That's good. And that whole idea of men getting pregnant and having children, that's a whole nother radio program. We'll have to discuss that another time. One of the chapters that says abortion harms politics and the democratic process. And in that chapter, you quote Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock, who said that as a pro-choice pastor, I've always believed that a patient's room is way too small for a woman, her doctor, and the United States government. So the imagery here is of a very personal moment, a woman in a hospital setting where the government is right there with her. How do you address that imagery? I think the left is good at scaring, and they cast this imagery of doom and destruction for the woman who might be forced, if you will, to have this child. How do we address this kind of imagery that Senator Warnock puts forward?
Yeah, you hear a lot of this from the left. And I think the first answer I would give is, who is the doctor, right? They speak about the doctor in the situation as though it's some, you know, lifelong family friend, caring relationship, you know, who cares deeply for the woman, is trying to make sure that her best interests are being taken care of. The doctor that they're citing is actually the abortionist, right? This is not, an abortionist is very, very rarely, if ever, someone's primary care doctor, someone the woman has a relationship with. This is someone who is going to, you know, stands to profit if the woman goes through with having an abortion. And I think the language here, of course, the idea of the government being in the room sounds oppressive and frightening. But they speak about this maternal, you know, or female doctor relationship, doctor patient relationship, as though the doctor is some kind of counselor or supportive friend or partner, when in fact they are going to gain financially if the woman has an abortion. And so I think when someone raises that kind of imagery, that's where I like to go, because the question of whether the government should be there is really a question of what is abortion and is it right or wrong again. But I like to kind of poke a hole in it that way.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. Moving right along, a U.S. district court ruled that the distribution of mifepristone is illegal. That is a chemical abortion used up to the 12th week in pregnancy. The U.S. Supreme Court put that on hold. Alexandra, tell us briefly, why is that case important?
Yeah, this is a really big case. It's extremely important primarily because the majority of abortions in the U.S. right now are chemical abortions. So this is a drug taken in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy to induce a miscarriage, you know, kill the unborn baby and induce a miscarriage, which of course is wrong because it's an abortion killing a human being. But it's also very dangerous for women. And over the past couple of years in particular, we've seen this push for women to be able to get chemical abortion drugs via telemedicine without ever seeing a doctor in person. That's currently the policy of the federal government, of the FDA. And this is very dangerous for women on top of course, the child, right? That a woman, without knowing how far along in pregnancy she is, without knowing if she might have an ectopic pregnancy, she's just being prescribed these drugs, taking them at home by herself. There are all kinds of complications that could ensue, particularly if she hasn't been seen by a doctor. And many women, there are, you know, countless anecdotal stories of women suffering really severe trauma after the fact, you know, seeing their unborn child after they've, you know, induced abortion at home alone. It's really horrific stuff, and it's dangerous for women. So I think the outcome of this case is really important.
Are you optimistic that the court will uphold that lower court's restriction on mifepristone?
I tend to think probably they will, but I would defer to my colleague Ed Whalen on that, because he reads the tea leaves much more effectively and is a very reliable source on this.
Very good. Well, when you first wrote the book Tearing Us Apart, by the way, I'm going to give a plug right now before we run out of time, but great book for those interested in learning more about arguments against abortion and really what it does to not just women, but to men, to the family, to the rest of society in various parts of society. strongly recommend this book. It can be found on Amazon and other places where books are sold. So I want to thank you for writing that. Alexander, we have just 2 minutes. Could you speak to those in the pro-life movement? We're at a very different place now than we were a year ago before the Dobbs decision. But what advice would you have to pastors, church leaders, other voices in the pro-life movement when speaking to this issue of life? What words of wisdom or encouragement would you share with them?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say is I really think everybody has a role right now. And I know it's not the most comfortable thing for everybody to feel like they have to talk about this or think about it or get involved. But I really think it's a crucial moment for pro-lifers to step up and find what your place is here, right? Is it volunteering at a pregnancy resource center? Is it, you know, political activism? What is it? Is it a role at church? Find your place, because I think there's plenty for everybody to do and everyone has a calling here. And then secondly, I would say I really would try to lead with empathy as much as possible. You know, at the kind of top line national level, we see a lot of nastiness. And I think people have, you know, being willfully ignorant and lying and all sorts of malicious things. But at the person-to-person level, I think there are a lot of people who are really seeking the truth and they've been misled by a lot of lies, by a lot of hatred. And they really want what's best for women. They want to be open to life, I think, at the end of the day. Try to really hear where they're coming from, build relationships with them, and then be willing to speak the truth no matter where it leads.
Yeah, no, that's good. Again, Alexandra DeSanctis, thank you so much for joining us. Your book, Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing, highly recommend it. I want to thank you for writing this. Thank you for being a voice for the unborn, an articulate, intelligent voice for unborn life. Just thank you so much for what you're doing. If people wanted to get in touch with you or find more about your work, how can they contact you, or what website would you point them to?
Sure. Most of my work is published online at the Ethics and Public Policy Center website, so eppc.org. I'm also on Twitter, and I write regularly for National Review.
Alexandra DeSanctis, thank you so much for joining us. God bless you, and you keep up the good work.
Growing up as a child, who did you turn to whenever you had a crisis? Who was your source of strength? Who held you in the darkest situations and became your beacon of light? Most of us will recall the love of our parents, our grandparents, our family. But the harsh reality today is that there are many who face the dark places of life totally alone. Since 1869, the mission and the ministry of Sunrise Children's Services has been to help children in crisis. Everyone with a passion for children can join us in giving hope to children in need. To learn more, just visit sunrise.org.